Echo Spinball offers monthly tournaments and a selection of games from the 1970s to the present. Learn more at northcoastpinball.com.
Yes, yes, yes. You are listening to X-Ray FM. That's KXRY Portland at 91.1 FM, K296 FT West Haven, serving Portland at 107.1 FM.
1,300 hours.
And a very unusual thing happening on our automation computer. Apologies. We're also at K219 KU Nehalem, serving the Oregon coast at 91.7 FM. Streaming live and archived at xray.fm. It is time for Garden Party. Take it away, Megan.
It is time for Garden Party. And at least the automation computer was correct. It is 1,300 hours, which means it's the last Monday of the month at that time, and it's time for Garden Party. Welcome, welcome. I'm Megan McMillan, an Oregon State University Extension Master Gardener volunteer, and I will be your host for the next hour. And I just want to encourage everyone to take a breath. If you are listening to Democracy Now! Just now, first, I want to thank you for continuing to stay engaged, for continuing to stay informed. That's what we're here for at X-Ray FM. That's why community radio is so powerful. And there's just a lot going on out there right now. And I really want to encourage all of you to continue to take care of yourself and your families and take breaks from that in whatever way you need. And for me, it's gardening for sure. I hope to encourage you to join me in that. But whatever it is that you need to stay grounded right now, it's more important than ever. I'm really lucky to be an OSU Extension Master Gardener. It's really a win-win because I get steeped in all of the research-based information that's coming out of Oregon State, just this incredible research university in agriculture, forestry, botany, all sorts of sciences. And I then get the honor of giving that to you. And that's really what the role of OSU Extension is. We extend the scientific knowledge that OSU has to you, to members of our community. And it's such an honor to get to do that the last Monday of the month with you. It may not be planting weather out there in the Willamette Valley right now. The rain is going to return tomorrow if the forecast is accurate, but it is cold. So what can you do? Right now it's the time to think about systems. What systems do you need to put in place for this gardening season to be a success for you? And there's nothing more beneficial that you can set up than a compost system for yourself on site if you have the room for it. So what is compost? You know, it transforms essentially garbage, but really debris, from your yard and from your meals, and it turns it into this nutrient-rich organic matter. It's all the fertilizer that most plants need. It's free. And it's a closed loop system. So instead of contributing to the use of fossil fuels that we need to have to haul away that waste, you're keeping it on site. And I do want to give some love to any cities who have municipal composting. That's amazing. Even with my own composting system on site, which I'm going to tell you about today, I still do use my green bin. And municipal composting is a game changer for reducing waste in landfills. So I don't just want to knock, like, I don't want to completely knock down the idea of having some of that that waste go away. But I hope to inspire you today to close the loop at home as much as you can. We'll dig into that, no pun intended. And then halfway through the show, be sure to stick around. I've got Shelby Lynn, who's going to join us in the studio from Wildwood Folk School. Foraging has grabbed national headlines after 3 people died and over 30 were sickened from eating wild mushrooms this winter in California. You may have heard about it, may have freaked you out. And yeah, you do have to be really careful out there, folks. You got to know what you're doing when you're foraging for wild foods, especially fungi. But Shelby, thankfully for us, is an expert on this exact subject, so we're lucky to learn from her later today. Stick around for that. You can text me anytime throughout the show at 971-220-KXRY with your questions. Just, you know, let me know what's going on in your yards. Let me know what you want me to cover this year. This is Garden Party on X-Ray FM, where radio is yours. We're back after the break with all the dirt on composting.
I know you think I think
Welcome back to Garden Party on X-Ray FM. I hope you just enjoyed Dirty Love from Mountjoy's self-titled 2018 album. So pop quiz. My regular listeners should know the answer. What's the difference between dirt and soil? You should know this. Dirt is inert and soil is alive. Bacteria, fungi, insects, worms, they're super hard at work under our feet and they're mostly digesting decaying matter. And this matter is a critical part of a healthy soil ecosystem. It adds structure and porosity. It holds water. It adds nutrients. This is the natural biological cycle of growth and decay, and it is happening under our feet all the time. So when you compost, you're just finishing the play on that natural cycle in a dedicated space, and there's a lot of advantages to this. So before we talk about how to go about composting, let's cover what compost should be made of, because the mix matters. Essentially, you need a mix of what we generalize as green and brown matter. So green matter, that's your high moisture, it's high nitrogen content. This is fruit and veggie scraps, grass clippings, any green clippings from the garden, essentially anything that's not dried out yet. If it's green, it's green. It could also be orange or yellow or those veggie and fruit scraps, but you know what I mean. So brown matter is your low moisture content. So this is straw, wood chips, autumn leaves count as this because, right, they sort of dry up on their own. And they both have their important jobs in compost. So green matter provides energy, and that's important for that fast microbial growth that you need to turn that that waste, both brown and green waste, into a finished product. But brown matter is really important too because it aerates the compost pile. And like all living things, air, water, nutrients, they all matter. And so your compost pile needs that air. It needs that brown matter. If you put in too much green matter, the materials are too wet, they get too dense, they don't allow enough air into the compost pile. And without that oxygen, the natural decay cycle, it goes super wonky and you're going to get this foul, rotten odor because it is rotting in there. And that's not really what you want. Decay and rot are not 100% the same thing. And so if you put in too much brown matter, then it's too low in moisture and too low in nutrients to decay quickly on its own. It will decay over time, but not as quickly as you might like, especially since you're trying to hasten this process on site. So the ideal ratio of brown to green matter is 2:1. And so in other words, mix one part green matter, like the plant and veggie waste, to two parts brown matter, like leaves or wood chips or dried out stalks of corn or something like that. And that's your healthy composting system. And so about that brown matter, the smaller the particle size, the faster the decay process. So if you're putting woody branches into your compost without chipping them up, expect them to take a super long time to break down. Personally, this is what I use my municipal green bin for. I don't have the means to have a wood chipper on my own on site. If you have a local tool library, they may have one available. Check it out. But anything I can't break down on my own, I contribute to my city compost. Thank you, to the West Side for having municipal compost available. Super appreciate that. I also know folks who use a mower to break leaves and garden clippings into smaller particles to make that decay process go faster. So smaller means faster. What not to put in? Don't put in pet waste, don't put in bones, don't put in dairy. Your local municipal compost may accept animal products as food waste, but don't put it in your home compost system. So that home compost system, the method that you choose, it's really going to depend on a lot of things. One, where do you live? How much space do you have? What material do you have to compost? How much of it? What do you want to compost? How much time and energy do you have? And then, of course, what are you going to do with it? So we'll cover what you can do with compost later. But first, let's sort of cover how you might approach this. And I'm going to go from the least amount of labor to the most amount of labor. So the easiest way to compost is called in-place composting. Really what that means is you bury organic matter directly into your garden soil. So you're going to want to dig down pretty deep. Again, you still want to get that ratio right. And, you know, at least a foot down into the soil. put in your veggie scraps, put in a little bit of brown matter, and then make sure you cover all of that fully, or you're likely going to have some sort of animal digging it up, which is probably not a mess that you want, but this is the lowest cost of entry to composting. You just bury it right in the ground and let it decompose. Now, if you're trying to convert a large area of, let's say, lawn to workable land, you can take in-place composting to the next level through something called sheet mulching. And this is where you cover your cut lawn with like thick cardboard or newspaper. You might have heard of this as the lasagna method. I talked about it when we were talking about how to get rid of your lawn. And so then you go in layers. That's why it's called the lasagna method. So you've got your thick cardboard newspaper down first, and then you alternate green material, brown material. Green material, brown material. Make sure you've got that brown material on top. This method is going to take many, many months, but it's an amazing way to convert lawn into a plantable space. Now, most households have some sort of, you know, like we call it add-as-you-go composting system. This could use a pile. It could use a bin. It doesn't have to be fancy. You could use pallets. You could make sort of bins with cinder blocks. You could, of course, go out and purchase a bin if you want. Personally, what I have at home, what I like, is agricultural mesh. Think of that as like super tight chicken wire framed with some lumber, because that lets air into the compost, but it doesn't let pests in. And I have something called a 3-bin system. So what this is you put that fresh matter in the first bin, of course, keeping that 2-to-1 brown to green ratio. And once that is full, then I turn it into the second bin, where that's where I'm sort of keeping it well watered, keeping that decaying process going. It's hard at work. And then finally, I turn it into the last bin. And that's where the compost essentially finishes breaking down. You might hear this or read this as cures. That's where the compost finishes the work. And by having 3 bins, you're kind of constantly cycling the in and out. And it, you know, it requires space, but it's a pretty tried and true method. Now, the more work you're willing to put in, regularly turning your compost, keeping it moist, balancing green and brown matter, the more robust the decay process is going to be, and the more that it will result in the release of heat. So that is what is often referred to as hot composting. Hot composting is nice because it's fast. It only takes about 6 to 8 weeks to go from raw green and brown matter to usable organic mulch. It also kills a lot of weed seeds and other pathogens when it gets super hot, so it's great. But cold composting, and that's essentially where you just let it sit, that works too. It just takes longer. And of course, it wouldn't kill any weeds. I'm pretty hands-off with my composting system, so mine doesn't get that hot. That's why I use my municipal bin for any plants I wouldn't want to reproduce in my own yard. That's because the municipal compost pile is going to get so much hotter than my home system. And friendly reminder, any seriously invasive plants or diseased plants, I don't even take a chance at them re-entering the ecosystem through city compost. I bin those. There's also tumbler bins out there. They can be helpful because they keep rodents and other pests away from kitchen scraps. If you opt for a tumbler bin, word of warning, just think about how easy it will be to get the finished compost back out. Also recognize that you're sort of going to have to take a break from composting at some point. You can't constantly feed it with new, especially green matter, and expect to be able to empty out that bin and have finished compost. There's also vermicomposting. That is a very fancy word for composting with worms. That's my chosen method for kitchen scraps because you have to have sort of a closed container for vermicomposting, and it keeps away any rodents or pests. It's super fun. You could have pet worms. Usually those bins use something called red wriggler worms, which you can usually get from a local garden store. I know we've got lots of great places in the Willamette Valley where you can get them. And you might think, oh, isn't that going to be stinky or weird? Actually, no. The smaller the space that you have, the more that I encourage you to vermicompost your kitchen scraps. You can even have a bin inside as long as it's well-tended, as long as you make sure that you are having brown and green matter in there. You can actually have that inside. So what sort of composting method are you using in your home garden? You run into any issues with it? I want to hear about it. Tell me about it at 971-220-KXRY. You're listening to Garden Party on X-Ray FM on KXRY Portland, streaming online everywhere, of course, at xray.fm. Let's take a break.
Sylvia, my baby, I have got to go away. In the morning when you rise, I'll be halfway down the highway. Neither of my two minds can decide if I'm at home on the road when I know the road ain't any kind of home. Sylvia, don't forget me. Sylvia, feel like I'm missing everything. So alone, I'm not with you. Good nights that I've missed. Every time your cheek goes unkissed. A day for me is a week for you. My life's already halfway through. Tomorrow, today's worries might turn out to be regrets. Tomorrow, yesterday's glories will be a memory.
Welcome back to Garden Party on X-Ray FM. That was Sylvia from Julian Baker and Taurus. That was released alongside their single Dirt last year. So we're talking about compost, and you followed my instructions. You mixed your 2-to-1 ratio. You've got 2 parts brown to 1 part green matter. You've hopefully kept the rodents away, and now you've got a big crumbly pile of finished compost. It should smell good, like the forest floor. That's how you know you've got the good stuff. So what do you do with it? Let's revisit why compost is awesome. So other than creating that closed loop recycling system on site, finished compost is going to improve your soil's ability to store water. It is going to provide nutrients for plants, for soil organisms. And some edible plants may require more concentrated fertilizer, but honestly, the average landscape is going to get everything that it needs from compost, the average landscape plant. So here's what you do with it. If you're building a new garden bed, I recommend that you apply, you know, a good 3-to-4-inch layer of compost to the soil surface. Work it in just slightly with a fork or a spade. You don't want to dig down. That will disrupt the delicate soil structure. But that's what to do if you've got a new garden bed. You want a pretty thick layer, 4 inches on top of that soil. If you have an existing garden bed, before you plant, just apply, you know, probably more like 1 inch of compost to the bed surface every year, because it's existing. You don't want to over fertilize. You don't want too many nutrients. That's just going to create runoff, might even create plant problems, might even create pest problems. You can't overdo it. And so when I say beds, this could mean in place in the soil. It can mean a raised bed or container. But word of warning, if you are planting in a raised bed or container, it's important you don't use only compost as your planting matter. Please don't do that. If you're in a raised bed, you need a soil mix specifically made for containers. That's going to be a mix of something like perlite or vermiculite that adds that drainage, that lightness to it. Definitely want some compost in there. And then, you know, I like blends that have coconut coir or other sort of forest products, they might call it that. Traditionally, soil mixes for raised beds did include peat moss, but peat harvesting is a major source of greenhouse gas emissions and it destroys wetlands. So I encourage you to avoid peat based soil mixes if you can. Back to compost. If you're just adding a new plant to your landscape here or there, you know, I again sort of just follow those instructions, but in a smaller space. So spread a about 4-inch layer of compost over the area that you intend to plant, mix it in pretty well, and then install the new plants into the amended soil right there. Here's a question that I get. Do I need to run my compost through a screen before I add it to my garden? Honestly, no, this isn't a must. I do run my compost through a simple screen. Again, it's just through that agricultural mesh before I add it to my garden. But that's only to take out the largest particles that really haven't decayed yet. I put those back into my working compost system so they can finish the decay process. It won't hurt anything to have larger particles out there in the garden. They'll eventually break down. It just won't look as aesthetically pleasing as perhaps purchased compost mix does. So it's really up to you. You may also be asking, can I add manure to my compost? And so like I said before, for most pet waste, the answer to this is a hard no. Dog and cat waste, other meat eaters, that's going to include pathogens that are very harmful to humans. They will not break down in the average composting system at home. Even chicken, rabbit, horse manure, you know, those are plant eaters, that poses somewhat of a risk of salmonella and E. coli surviving your compost pile because, again, it might not get hot enough to kill those. And, you know, think about where you're using it. That's the advice that I would give because if those don't break down all the way and you are adding to your raised bed and then you are planting strawberries on top, those strawberries are going to be sitting right on the surface of the soil. They're going to be eaten raw. Or you might be growing carrots or another root vegetable that's right in the soil. You may also eat those raw. And so if that salmonella or E. coli, you know, survived the compost pile, then you're essentially going to end up eating that too. So it's just advice to sort of lessen your risk there is to let that chicken or horse manure rot separately for a year or make sure that you're really mindful about how long you are letting your compost break down. A year is a sort of good measure before you are adding it to any space with edible crops. Just a way to protect yourself, protect anyone who's eaten those veggies or fruits. Another concern with manure is sometimes the, you know, persistent herbicides that can contaminate your compost. So think whoever ate those. It might be hay. It might be straw sold for bedding. Those are usually the biggest culprits. Herbicides might have been used on those. They eat them. They get into your compost. And unfortunately, the hot compost isn't going to get rid of those herbicides. And so if you are purchasing either grass hay for animal feed, if you are using horse manure, something like that, if you're composting straw that would normally be bedding, just try and do a little bit of research on your supply chain to understand if herbicides were used. Because, of course, the goal of herbicides is to kill plants. And so you don't want to put something in your plants that's going to kill those plants. Here's a few other questions we master gardeners sometimes receive about composting. One, okay, your pile's not breaking down. If that's the case, if you're not seeing decay, it probably needs more green matter and probably more water. Again, you don't want it sopping wet, but you do need to get out there during the dry periods and water your compost pile a little bit because air, water, nutrients, all of these things are important to life. And life is what is breaking down that waste in that compost pile. So it can't be bone dry out there. And again, make sure you've got that 2-to-1 ratio of brown to green. If your compost pile or bin smells, if it's really foul, that means it has turned anaerobic. That means it's probably too wet, the opposite of what I just described. Probably needs more air, less water. The thing to do with that is add brown matter. Add that straw, add wood chips, add even sawdust if you've got a home shop or something like that. And make sure you're turning that pile more regularly to get air in there. This time of year when it's cold outside, just know your pile's going to break down much more slowly. It may even stop decaying. The bigger your pile, the more chance it has to hold heat. So maybe consider a larger composting system. But know that in this cold weather, it's just normal for that life to slow down. If you're struggling with attracting rodents, using a bin, again, that has that agricultural mesh on all sides, including the bottom, is one way to get around it. If you compost a lot of food waste and you are struggling with flies, make sure any food waste is always buried several inches below that brown material. So I struggle with this as well. Any veggie scraps, any eggshells, I've got to make sure that that's buried pretty deep under brown material or other green material that that wouldn't necessarily be attractive to flies. As I've said before, make sure there's no bones, no dairy, no other animal products in there. I know I just said eggshells, and that is an animal product. What I do is I rinse my eggshells out. They're great for compost. They add calcium to the finished product. They're really, really awesome, but I usually make sure that I am rinsing those out beforehand. Now, you may have heard of something called compost tea. And often this is the liquid runoff from vermicomposting. That's the worm composting that I mentioned earlier. But you can also brew, I'm using air quotes here, brew compost tea with compost and water and create a really nice liquid fertilizer. But I want to do some myth busting out there on compost tea because there's a myth that it's an effective pesticide and herbicide when it's sprayed on plants. So in common terms, this just means like, hey, there's a soundbite out there that you spray this compost tea onto plants and it keeps pests away, keeps diseases away. Sadly, this has been researched. It has not been proven. There have been lots of studies on this. One that I read about preparing for this episode was up from our neighbors at the University of Washington. They sprayed the cherry trees in Washington Park Arboretum up there with compost tea, half with water, to see if it could combat cherry blossom brown rot. And it did not. It made no difference. In some cases, it actually made it worse. Because here's the truth. If a landscape has serious soil or plant health problems, compost tea is not going to solve it. Your plant's got to be in the right place with the right care. If you're overusing pesticides or fungicides or disrupting that ecosystem, if your soil is compacted or out of balance, adding compost tea is not going to get you out of that problem. You got to solve the real problem. You are listening to Garden Party on X-Ray FM. I am curious, have you run into any of these compost issues? Are you looking for advice? Text me at 971-220-KXRY. We'll chat about it after our next segment.
Jumping up and down the floor, my hat is an animal, and once there was an animal, it had a son that mowed the lawn. The son was an okay guy, they had a pet dragonfly. The dragonfly ran away, but it came back with a story to say. We'll be right back. were scared down in their homes. The forest that once was green was colored black by those killing machines. But she and her furry friends took down the queen bee and her men. And that's how the story goes, the story of the bees with those four dirty paws. La la la, la 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 la, la la la.
That was Dirty Paws by Of Monsters and Men. And if you aren't already inspired to get your own paws a little bit dirty, my next guest will surely get you there. Today, we welcome Shelby Lynn of Wildwood Folk School to Garden Party Radio to teach us about responsible foraging. And Shelby's actually here in the studio with me. Shelby, welcome. So happy to have you here.
Hi, Megan. Thank you so much for having me. This is such a lovely program, and I'm so excited.
Yeah. So the standard intro question that we always ask, how long have you been gardening? How did you get your start?
Yeah, I actually am a gardener, but I'm going to talk a little bit about how I got started in foraging.
Yes.
Because there's just so much overlap between these two. I was really lucky to have a grandmother who was into historical societies mm-hmm. as a child. And I remember at a really young age, she would like point out, she'd be like, ooh, that sticky monkey flower. And I think children have a really natural curiosity about the natural world and start like putting little plants in their mouths and stuff. And luckily I had a family who supported that mm-hmm. and just started eating a lot of weird weeds. I was also homeless as a teenager, and that's when I got a lot more serious about foraging. Mm-hmm. Cause you know, sleeping under a bridge is a bummer,
yeah.
But living in the woods and making bread out of plantain and eating wild oyster mushrooms, it's my side of the mountain. It's a great time.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. I feel like so many people's origin stories with gardening or anything mm. wonderful start with their grandmothers. I certainly share that with you as well. Okay, so foraging.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you get the honor of doing this? Where do you adventure to?
Ugh, Megan, I love that word, the honor, because it is like, it's a human right to be able to interact with the natural world and mm-hmm. to be able to eat wild plants and lichens and fungi, but it's also such an honor and a privilege.
Yeah,
I think for me, it's kind of all kinds of places. I think we have a public perception that foraging only happens in like pristine wilderness, in like deep mountains where you could never go. And that could be a barrier for a lot of folks mm-hmm. to start foraging. And of course, there are incredible species in those places, but also you can forage in your garden. You can forage on the streets of a city. Like, urban lots have so much biodiversity and so much to offer. So for me, foraging is kind of a mindset of keeping open the possibilities and utilities of all of these species, and being aware of how to interact with them. Kind of wherever you go.
Yeah, so foraging is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere and anywhere. And I think mm-hmm. that's really cool to think about, because, you know, we humans are the ones that converted most of this to cement. And so if we're going to do that, we're lucky if plants are still around us. And, mm-hmm. and if they are, you know, what we would have been doing originally and what all animals do is just looking around for food. And so we're kind of just returning to that natural state wherever we are. So I know one of the things that that you teach others to forage is mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually something, as an OSU Extension Master Gardener, that's something I actually cannot answer questions on. So that's mm-hmm. something I'm really excited to have you here to teach our audience a little bit about them.
Hooray.
So let's like break it down to the basics first, because I'm always talking about plants here.
Mm-hmm.
But fungi are not plants. What makes them different?
Yeah, absolutely. So a really interesting thing about the fungal kingdom is that 69.
What?
I know. Yeah, it's crazy. It's really, really a burgeoning and kind of a baby science in a lot of ways. And one of the things that's really exciting about it is like science has named an estimated 4 to 10% of the terrestrial species of fungi. And that's just the land species. Like, we don't know almost anything about the mushrooms of the ocean, but they are there.
My mind just exploded.
I know. And I feel like it's so exciting and kind of democratizing in a way, because as an individual, as a citizen scientist, like, you might discover a species that has not been named by science. That is a real possibility.
Oh, that is so cool. That is so cool. Undiscoverable knowledge. Mm-hmm. Or undiscovered knowledge, not discoverable. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what role do they play?
Yes.
Because I know they're very important. They're not just a side species. Mm-hmm. They're not a side chick. They've got a major role out there.
They're a main deal. But if it's okay, I didn't really answer your question.
Okay, yeah.
Very
oh, yeah,
well.
You're right. Yeah, I just got too excited. I got too excited.
Always. So some of the things that really differentiate fungi from plants. Fungi in some ways are more like animals than plants. So they don't photosynthesize. They're not absorbing energy from the sun like plants are. They're actually heterotrophs. So they have to eat other beings in order to survive, just like animals do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And reminder, Garden Party listeners, what makes plants a plant? It makes their own food.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. There are a couple of animals who also photosynthesize, but it's because they're friends with an algae, so it's cheating. They also have exoskeletons made of chitin around every single one of their cell walls.
Okay.
So it's like an insect's exoskeleton or an arthropod's exoskeleton.
But around every single cell.
Every single cell, yeah. They also, they store their food in the form of sugar, but it's instead of being sucrose like plants have, they store it in the form of glycogen, which is more similar to animals. And when we think about the body of a fungus, the popular understanding is often thinking about, a cute little mushroom. We've got little spots on it. Mm-hmm. But that's just the fruiting body of a fungus. Mm-hmm. So mushroom-producing fungi are actually these intricate networks underground called mycelial networks. It's like a complicated web of tiny, tiny rootlets, kind of, sort of. Mm-hmm. And that's the body of the fungus. And the ones that produce mushrooms are producing them just like fruiting bodies. So it's essentially the berry from a bush. Mm-hmm. So both more similar to our bodies than plants, and also entirely alien, this whole weird thing of their own.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an iceberg effect. Yeah. That's what I'm hearing there. Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. So totally different little creatures out there. What role do they play in our ecosystem?
Yeah, they play a huge role. And like you were talking about with soil sciences earlier, one that's often kind of underappreciated because so much of what they're doing is unseen. Let me back up. Some things that mushrooms are doing, they're playing important roles in nutrient cycling, in carbon sequestration, in building and aerating soil. And
you're listening to X-Ray FM, KXRY Portland at 91.1 and 107.1 FM.
See, even,
on the coast
even the
Yellen,
automation
Indonesia,
computer got
Beach.
Excited about all this stuff. We, you know, the live radio folks. All right. Everyone's excited.
Yay.
Let's get back to it.
But fungi can have really different roles in the ecosystem, and it's best described by their trophic types, the way that they eat. So there's saprophytic or saprobic mushrooms. Those are the decomposers, the kind of classic model of they're breaking down wood, they're breaking down leaves. There's also mycorrhizal mushrooms, which are the ones that form a symbiotic, mutualistic relationship with plants by attaching to their little roots. Mm-hmm. There's also parasitic mushrooms, pathogenic mushrooms. So there's ones that you would come up for you as a gardener, like anthracnose is a really well-known one. Mm-hmm. Ones that feed off of either plants, other mushrooms, or off of people. If you saw The Last of Us, that's a wildly inaccurate but very fun story about a real genus of mushrooms called cordyceps that really do prey on animals. And then there's also endophytic ones that live in the interstitial space between plant cells. And you will never see them unless you cut open that plant and you're looking at it with a microscope.
Wow.
It's pretty cool.
Okay,
yeah.
That is wild.
Yeah.
So now here I am. I am a human. Mm-hmm. I want to eat these things.
Yeah, you do.
I want to go out into the world and find them. I'm hearing from you. We don't know a lot about all of them yet. We know very little. There's so many different kinds. When you're foraging for mushrooms, Where do you start? What do you look for?
Yeah, that's such a great question. There are so many places to start that it can sometimes feel a little overwhelming.
Yeah.
But a couple of things that I'd really recommend. First off, just making sure that you are learning from knowledgeable folks. So joining a mycological society, wherever you're at, is always a good idea. Or going out with like trained experts. Fortunately or unfortunately, that is still the best way to confidently identify mushrooms in the field. It's also great to have a good guidebook. The kind of classic one that everybody starts with is All That the Rain Promises and More. A lovely little book. But I can't emphasize enough the importance of going out and doing it with real people,
mm-hmm.
In whatever context works best for you.
Mm-hmm.
I'd also recommend, because the fungal kingdom is so wildly diverse, and like you were saying, there is much we don't know, and there's much we do know, starting with a few easy to identify species or even genera, and really focusing on those.
Mm-hmm.
There are some mushrooms that are really tricky and have like deadly lookalikes. Those aren't the ones you want to start with. The ones you want to start with are often called the foolproof four, or I would say the foolproof five. So these are 4 to 5 genera of fungi that are common, extremely delicious, and have no real dangerous lookalikes.
Okay.
So they're hard to mess up and easy to find.
Okay.
So lobster mushrooms, oyster mushrooms, puffball mushrooms, chanterelles, and morels.
Okay. And do all of those grow here in Oregon?
Every single one of them.
I'm making an assumption that Oregon is a very good place for mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
Is that assumption correct?
That assumption could not possibly be more correct.
Do you think that this unseasonably dry January and December will ruin our fun?
Our fun guy.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I didn't even know to do that. That was so good.
I'm sorry. It's a very overused pun, but someone has to do it.
Yeah.
It may. It will depend. We're getting some good rain in the Cascades, luckily.
Okay.
But it will depend a lot on what happens later in the season. There's kind of two periods of more extreme fungal growth. So, of course, in the fall and then also in the springtime. And the fungi are triggered to bloom or fruit when the temperature is right and also when there's enough moisture. So if we see a good amount of rain in the spring, we might still have an awesome fungal season.
Okay.
And we might not.
And so the fungi that are dangerous, what makes them so dangerous for us to eat? Do we know? No, we don't know. Why do some of them kill us and some of them taste amazing?
There's some that we know and there's some that we don't know. There's actually, there was a really great lecture at the Oregon Mycological Society's fall show this year from this man at the Poison Control Center who talked in very frightening terms about the most poisonous mushroom called the death cap.
Mm-hmm. This is the one that's killing people in California right now.
And
I'm like, okay, avoid.
Yeah, avoid the noid. It's an appropriately sinister name. And fungi can actually kill us or hurt us in a number of ways. Some of them can cause severe gastrointestinal distress. Some of them can cause liver toxicity, even liver failure. What I would really recommend in terms of safety is making sure that you have identified your mushroom correctly. If you're not sure, you know, when in doubt, throw it out.
Mm-hmm.
You can leave it alone if you're not sure what it is. Make sure that you have good resources for that identification. Make sure that you are preparing it in the right way. Preparation can definitely change the toxicity of plants, lichens, and fungi. It can also change their taste. Some things like candy cap mushrooms, which are pretty bland when they're fresh and raw, when they become dried, they taste like buttered waffles and are delicious. Yeah, so just making sure you're doing it in the right way. And then also I would advise people to stay away from the more difficult to identify genera. So the one we were just mentioning, death cap, is in the Amanita genus, which has both a bunch of incredibly delicious mushrooms like Kokora, Caesar's mushroom, springtime Amanita. It also has all of the big, very deadly mushrooms in it. And so, you know, if it's an Amanita, like, give it a few years. Make sure that you are really, really confident in your identification Because the best case scenario, you have a tasty lunch, and the worst case scenario, you eat no more lunch ever.
Mm-hmm. Okay, experts, documentation, research. Oh. This is one of those things where you got to do the work for sure. Now, you said something interesting before. You said a fruiting body. And so in plants, fruit is usually the end of the life cycle. It is trying to produce seed, the end of the life cycle. Is that the same for mushrooms?
That is such a good question. Because the fungal kingdom is so diverse, it just really, really depends.
Okay.
It is the case that most mushrooms, as the fruiting body, their job is to spread out their spores, which are like analogous to plant seeds, and then to die back. And so most of them live for a couple days to a couple months and then die. So in some ways, foraging fungi can be... you can take a lot more of them than you can of plants. It's easier to do that in a more ethical way without worrying about hurting the overall organism.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's still a lot of considerations there, and you want to make sure that you're not harvesting all or too much of anything. But there are also some fruiting bodies that live year after year after year and grow larger and are able to sporulate even more effectively. So my favorite example is Ganoderma organense, the artist conch. It's one that's best known because during the season when it sporulates, you can touch the white underside of this shelf fungus and it stains an indelible brown mark. So you can draw on it and it will be that way for decades. It's really, really lovely. It's also a wonderful medicinal, but those ones grow really slowly and they can live 65, occasionally even 70 years. So those are ones to treat in the same way that you would treat like a long-lived perennial plant.
Yeah.
And be much more mindful in your harvest.
Yeah, treat with reverence for sure.
Exactly.
And I am really excited to hopefully get out there and learn about foraging. And I also realize that sometimes I'm just home with my kids and I can't leave my house and I can't do that.
Mm.
So if I wanted to, as a home gardener, if I wanted to grow and harvest mushrooms at home, do you have any tips for me?
Yeah, absolutely. First off, kids love mushrooms.
That's true.
Yeah, it is my experience that children like to poke them and to boink them. And a fun thing you can do, if you don't know what it is, there is no mushroom that is unsafe to touch.
Okay.
That we have ever discovered. So you can just boink it on its little head. You just pop and it goes bloop. It just kind of woggles around.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a fun thing for kids to do just to feel connected. Whether or not you know how to eat or utilize that mushroom. But if you wanted to grow mushrooms at home, that's a really great idea. They can be really beneficial in the garden. We talked about those mycorrhizal ones that make that beautiful, symbiotic, mutualistic relationship with plants. Of the plants that we have studied, over 98% of them have existing mycorrhizal connections.
Yeah.
Which means like you already have mushrooms growing in your yard no matter what,
mm-hmm.
which is so beautiful. And they also help plants grow more efficiently because they're doing an exchange of minerals and water, nutrients and sugar. So planting mycorrhizal mushrooms in your yard, if you're able to, is really, really lovely, or encouraging their growth when you can. You can also use saprophytic mushrooms, the ones that are decomposers that break down that the cellulose in plants to add... diversity to your soil to help keep your soil more moist, which keeps your plants happier, and to also aerate it. So really great way to do that is to use inoculated bark chips and just spread them out over your yard, and they're very low maintenance. Just make sure you got a deep mulch going on, and as soon as there is the right temperature and enough water, they will produce fruit. By fruit, I mean mushrooms, of course.
Yeah,
it's not going to make an apple. And so two species I want to really recommend for home gardeners are species in the oyster genus,
okay,
which are edible, delicious, extremely easy to grow, and also King Strepharias or wine caps. They can grow up, the mushrooms themselves can be sometimes a foot and a half across, so you get a whole lot of bang for your buck. And both of these species are actually omnivorous, so they're both breaking down the plant material. And they're also hunting the nematodes in your soil.
Yes.
Yes.
You want to do this, friends.
You do. Especially if you have a nematode problem. And even if you don't, the mushrooms just taste nice. So you want it anyway.
I absolutely loved learning about this. You just got the chance to learn from Shelby Lynn. She is with Wildwood Folk School. Check it out. Shelby, thank you so much for joining us in the studio. Loved learning with you today.
Thank you so much for having us. It's really lovely to be here.
Bye.
Thanks.
Let's kick the beat. It's your turn. The conga drum.
Welcome back to Garden Party on X-Ray FM. That was Mushroom Hunting from the collection Cowboy Bebop Tank the Best. So there are actually three separate exclamation points in that. So that's why I read it that way. If you are not familiar with the music from the 1998 Japanese anime series Cowboy Bebop, it was recorded by the band Seatbelts. That's who you just heard. That was the brainchild of prolific composer, performer, and arranger Yoko Kanno. How delightful was that? And now I am delighted to answer your questions as a master gardener. So let's see what came in over the text line. 971-220-KXR. Why we've got a question here. Great show on mushrooms and compost. Thank you. I loved that too. I have a question involving both. So my neighbors give me all their fall leaves. Ah, yes, gold. I have a few piles that I will soon work into the top layer of my raised beds. And this is something you could put in your raised beds anytime, especially right now is great. So it will protect that soil from any compaction as the rain returns tomorrow. So the question was, do you have any advice on this? I would just say, get those leaves into the beds. You don't have to work them in too much. If you've got a compost pile, those are absolute gold for your compost pile. But just replicate what you would see in the forest. Those leaves do a very important job. Just put them on top of everything, and you can't go too thick. 4 inches of leaves is a great, great mulch. Again, if you wanted it to break down faster, just chop them down first, mow them, but you really don't have to. I don't do that. I put them all over the tops of my pots, my beds, everything. Also, there was a question about what type of edible mushroom can I introduce to these leaves? And so that is something where we just heard from Shelby Lynn of Wildwood Folk School. I am going to leave the mushroom questions to experts like her. You can also get in touch with OSU Extension, of course, but on her way out of the studio, Shelby just told me that they are about to start up at Wildwood Folk School this year's foraging cohort, and they got a bunch of free plant walks, so maybe check out Wildwood Folk School. You can ask that question IRL to an expert like Shelby. But can't give out mushroom advice to you. That's why I had Shelby here. Okay, here's another question. about grass clippings and whether you can compost those. So I mentioned that you could, but there's a few caveats there. So number one, if you have a lawn, hopefully you've accepted the truth at this point. It's the most high maintenance thing you're going to have out there, which means you're probably adding, you're probably reseeding, you're probably adding fertilizer. You might hear this referred to as weed and feed. I'm not going to give you a hard time for using this because lawns are super high maintenance. And if that's your choice, just go with it. There's a place for this. But you might be wondering, if I used weed and feed on my lawn, can I compost those grass clippings? And so here's the thing. One, how you mow a lawn is you want to always remove the top third of the grass every time you mow. And so if you do that and you weed and feed in the spring and you use that conventional fertilizer there, it's not going to be organic. It might not be something that you want to eat. Those first three mowings following a weed and feed application, you're going to want to get rid of those. You're not going to want to home compost those. From the fourth mowing on, the clippings would be fine to include in your compost and to apply to something like a vegetable garden. One more question, and then we got to be done for the day here. Is there a weed killer I can use to kill dandelions in my grass that would still make the clippings safe to compost? You could use an herbicidal vinegar. That's not going to be unsafe necessarily, but even remember, herbicidal vinegars, they're not selective. So anything that it hits, it's going to kill. That includes the grass that it's a part of. You could eventually compost that, though. Herbicidal vinegar isn't going to be something unsafe to eat as you compost. I'm Megan McMillan. I'm an Oregon State University Extension Master Gardener Volunteer. You can access everything from the OSU Extension at extension.oregonstate.edu. If you've got more questions I didn't answer, get in touch with a Master Gardener Volunteer at metromastergardeners.org. Again, many thanks to Shelby Lynn from Wildwood Folk School. See you next time.
I went to a garden party to reminisce with my old friends. A chance to share old memories and play our songs again. When I got to the garden party, they all knew my name. No one recognized me. I didn't look the same, but it's all right now. Learned my lesson well. You see, you can't please everyone, so you got to please yourself. People came from miles around, everyone was there. Yoko brought a walrus, there was magic in the air. And over in the corner, much to my